One November morning in 1988, a truck was set on fire near Bruce R. Watkins Drive, resulting in an explosion so powerful it cracked foundations.
107, you're reporting an explosion. You need extra companies?
10-4, and we're going to need ambulances.
10-4, is that for firefighters?
10-4, we've blown the windshield clear out of our car and we're a quarter mile away.
It also killed six Kansas City firefighters. A horrible moment for the fire department and the whole city. Brian Shepard was convicted of life without parole for his part in the deadly explosion. He was just 17 years old at the time. Juvenile sentencing has changed since then, so after serving nearly 22 years, Brian appeared in court for resentencing earlier this month. His family sat on one side of the courtroom, while relatives of the firefighters sat on the other. When the judge announced in legalese that Brian would be set free, you could hear whimpers and gasps, people quietly confirming what they'd just heard. Finally, court was adjourned, and the room erupted into sobs and applause. Here's Brian's daughter, Ashley, just outside the courtroom.
I'm overwhelmed with excitement, and I'm so pleased with the judge's decision. I know we all are.
Yes.
But I wish I could say I felt nothing but relief. And while looking across the aisle today, I could see that my father's release would not only bring happiness and joy to our family, but it would also bring further suffering to the families of the fallen firefighters.
Amen. Amen.
And for that, I am truly sorry. My heart aches for them today, as it always has.
You can hear in her voice, and you could hear in the amens, just how much emotion this incident, which took place almost 30 years ago, still carries for people on both sides of that courtroom. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to meet Brian Shepard, who's since been released from prison, and Mike McGraw, the journalist who's kept shining a spotlight on his case. Brian, good morning.
Good morning.
And Mike McGraw, hello to you too.
Good morning, Gina.
I'm going to start with Mike, and then we'll hear your story. Okay, Brian?
Okay.
So, Mike McGraw, you've been reporting on the explosion and its aftermath for years now. What do you think are the salient pieces of information people need to know about the explosion itself, the people involved, and the early legal proceedings to understand why Brian's release is such a momentous thing?
There's so many things. This is a huge, fascinating, and very complex case. The explosion occurred about 4 in the morning. It was there were actually several fires on this construction site where 71 Highway was being widened. A guard's truck was set on fire, an arson fire. And then after the firefighters put that out, they went up the hill to put out a fire in one of these trailers that was filled with ANFO. Ammonium nitrate and fuel oil, the same substance that was used in the Murrah Building explosion.
Why was such an explosive material in this trailer?
The construction company was blowing a rock ledge away and then grinding it into smaller pieces to use as the roadbed. So they had to widen the road, and there were rock ledges on, I think, both sides. So they were using this explosive to get rid of that and lower the roadbed.
And so, continue your story.
The firefighters went up the hill. They were fighting the fire in one of the trailers. The battalion chief at the time, Marion Gurman, showed up in his car, and right about the time he got there and told them to pull back, the explosion occurred, pulverized two Kansas City fire trucks, and killed six firefighters.
So you got involved in this story in the early 2000s. Do you remember finding out what happened when the blast first occurred in 1988?
Actually, I was working in Hartford that occurred, and I came back to the Star in 89. And then a local publisher, Pat O'Connor, came to me in 05, and he had several affidavits from prosecution witnesses who had changed their story, who had recanted. And he said, you ought to take up this case and take another look at it. I was dubious at first.
So wait, I want to back up a second because you're talking about witnesses who have recanted, but we haven't yet heard on what basis people were convicted in the first place. I mean, what was the prevailing narrative at that time?
Well, this was a tough case for the federal government. The explosion occurred in 88. No one was indicted until 96, 97. The trial was in 97. So the families had been waiting 9 years for some kind of closure on this case, for someone to be blamed. When Brian and his uncles and his best friend and Darlene Edwards were indicted, the evidence that the government had did not include DNA, no fingerprints. The explosion destroyed any physical evidence. There were no eyewitnesses that put them on the site that night. All they had was the testimony of people who claimed that Brian or another person had told them that they were up there that night.
So you get involved when this publisher comes to you and says, look, all these witnesses are recanting testimony. People were serving life sentences in prison, including Brian, who was a juvenile when he was convicted. What is it that captivated you? Because you didn't just do a story on this. You did several stories. You followed it from when you were at the Star to when you were at KCPT, and you even wrote a play about it.
I didn't write the play.
You didn't write the play. You were involved in this play. I mean, you took the story to Kansas City's theater community and really, like, were involved in this collaboration.
Well, there's a division of the Center for Investigative Reporting in California called StoryWorks, and they do plays based on investigative reporting. My bosses at KCPT took the idea to them. They loved the idea, and they hired local playwright Michelle Johnson, who wrote what to me is a fascinating play about this case. And the fascinating part of it is she created two prison guards, one of whom believed Brian was guilty, one of whom believed he was innocent.
And these are real characters?
They did not exist in real life. She created them for the play. But interestingly, a couple of Brian's guards wanted to come to the play. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, one was black, one was white, the same situation that we had in the play.
If you look back at Shakespeare or, like, classical plays from Greece and Rome, themes of justice and revenge are just reverberating through the millennia. Are those the themes in this story as you understand it as well?
Sure. They're the themes in any kind of crime and punishment story. But the person that comes to mind to me most when I think about this case is Kafka.
Why?
Kafka wrote about justice issues and how difficult it can be if you're targeted by the system, the trial, for one. And you're just facing this huge machine that wants to do what it thinks is justice. I think that the most important thing I learned from this is that often the judicial system is not so much about finding truth as it is about following of this strict set of rules and precedents that are at work in any trial.
Well, let's hear about the individual's story that might bring some of this theory of yours to light. I'm going to turn in just a second to Brian to hear his life and his story, including the story of the explosion from his point of view. Before I do that, is there anything else you want us to understand or appreciate from a journalistic standpoint?
Sure. From a journalistic standpoint, the editor who put me onto this story, who agreed that I could go forward with it, is Mark Zeman, who's no longer an editor at the Star. He's moved on to the company that owns the Star, but he took a chance in letting me just focus in on this case. It didn't win the Star many friends. But I think the other thing that fascinates me about this case is the way the government incentivized so many witnesses to come forward. They had legal problems pending. Sometimes those problems went away. There was a reward of $50,000. All of them were looking, arguably, for some money out of this case. So there was a lot of incentive for these prosecution witnesses to come forward.
What was the story they told?
The story they told was that either Brian or one of the other defendants had told them they were involved in the explosion.
Involved how?
It varied by witness. In fact, when you put all the witnesses' testimony together, they put Brian at several – so Brian had six witnesses against him. The other defendants had four or five. And they would put these defendants at different places at the very same time in time.
Well, we'll get back to Mike McGraw shortly. Brian Shepherd, what is it like to hear Mike McGraw talking about an incident that took place when you were 17 that's determined the course of the rest of your life in so many ways?
It's very hard to sit here and listen to it because I've lived it and been through it. You know, it started out a long time ago on a state level and continued on in the federal courts. It is very overwhelming. It's hard to compete with what he just spoke about.
You're not in competition, so don't worry about that. I mean, it's a pretty crazy story. And before we get into the story itself, I just want to know more about you. Like, what was your life like before the explosion? Where did you live?
Grew up in South Kansas City, Marlboro community. Went to Center School District. Like a low, medium income family neighborhood. You know, we didn't have sidewalks or nothing like that in our neighborhood. You know, there was a lot of, kind of poor people in my neighborhood, you know.
What was school like for you? You said you went to the Center School District.
Well, school was always hard for me because I was in special classes. I had learning disabilities. You know, I couldn't really read or write. You know, all the way till the day I got locked up, I was pretty much illiterate.
You know? How did that happen, going through a school system and coming out, like you said, pretty much unable to read or write?
I mean, back when I went to school, you could miss two or three days of school before they would even call your parents, you know, and they pretty much passed me off to the next teacher, you know, their problem. You know, they'd put me in a special classroom, you know, and throw some little puzzles at me. You know, they weren't really trying to educate me.
Why do you think that you struggled with school? I mean, what else was going on in your life? Is that related or unrelated?
Well, I had, as well as learning disabilities, I had, I was really hyper. They put me on Ritalin. You know, I couldn't sit still at all. You know, I couldn't focus. You know, school wasn't for me. You know, I wanted to run the streets and have fun and just play, you know. And that's how I live my life, just running most of the time.
Tell me about your family life.
Well, both my parents worked, so they made sure we had a roof over our head and clothes on our back and, you know, food on the table. But they basically let me run as well, you know, because they couldn't handle me. You know, I left home at 13 years old.
Where did you go?
I moved on the street behind and a friend of mine's house. And that's eventually where I was living at when I got shot.
When you got shot?
Yeah, I was 14 when I got shot.
Tell me more about that.
I was dating this girl I guess there was some jealousy I kind of broke up with her and it's kind of a fatal attraction type thing.
It sounds like, I mean, you had a pretty, I guess, at the very least, you could call it chaotic kind of life. I mean.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of traumatic events that took place at a short period of time. I was home one day when my grandpa shot himself. I got in a car wreck right after I got shot. You know, I was driving. I was 14. I shouldn't have been driving.
How do you look back on all of this now?
I was young and living a fast life. I was hanging out with the wrong people. You know, the people that I was hanging out with were, you know, a lot older than me. Like I said, school wasn't for me. The street life was, you know, that's where I fit in most.
I'm going to acknowledge that, just the way you are describing your teenage years is just dramatically different from the way I experienced my teenage years. And I think that's probably true for a lot of, not all of our listeners, but a lot of them. And I'm curious what you think people who didn't grow up with the circumstances you do maybe don't understand about that?
Well, in our community, I mean, there's people that excelled in our neighborhood. I wasn't, you know, the whole neighborhood wasn't like me. There was a lot of people that were, you know, the people that I hung around with didn't go to school. You know, they ran the streets all day and all night. You know, my parents went to work. They came home. They drank. You know, my father beat me, you know, so I hung out with kids likewise, you know.
So as we're approaching, you know, November of 1988, five people were convicted of aiding and abetting an arson, and the fire turned into a lethal explosion that killed several firefighters, as we've heard. You were convicted, and so were, I believe it was two of your uncles? Is that right?
Yeah, two of my uncles, my best friend, and my uncle's ex-girlfriend.
So tell me also about your uncles. I mean, what was your relationship with them?
Well, they grew up in that neighborhood before I did. So, you know, one was 10 years older and the other was 20 years older. So I basically had to follow in there, you know, behind them, you know. And they lived the same way I did. It's just, you know, they lived it harder, I guess.
What do you mean by that?
More disrespectful, you know. A lot less common sense, maybe.
And your dad didn't want you to hang around with him, did he?
No. You know, at a young age, you know, they were pretty abusive and belligerent drunks, you know, addicts. And my dad didn't want them around me. You know, they were a bad influence on me.
Take me back to the night and early morning of that fire from your perspective. Just tell me about that night as you lived it.
That was a typical day in the neighborhood. You know, I lived in a neighborhood where there was pretty much a dope house or a party house on, you know, just about any street in Marlboro. And that's the way I grew up, running up and down those streets, jumping from house to house, you know, driving through all the neighborhood parks. And we did that every day. You know, we'd jump in the car and put some gas in it and go buy some cigarettes and travel, you know, hit house to house, park to park, you know, and party to party. That's just a normal day.
Is that so? That's what you were doing that November day?
Yep, running around, drinking, smoking, jumping from house to house, park to park.
So how did your family get involved in the story about this fire or these fires and the explosion that resulted from your perspective?
Well, where the tragedy took place, there's our neighborhood's like right next to it, you know, and the Shepherd name is very well known in the neighborhood. I wouldn't say popular, but, you know, I was pretty popular in school. That's everybody knew who I was because when I left home at 13, we started this place called The Cave in the basement of a house. It was a massage parlor place in the daytime, and it was party central at night. And so we were pretty well known in the neighborhood. Plus, I had to follow in the footsteps of my uncles terrorizing the neighborhood, so my name is really well known. You know, kind of infamous, I guess.
When did you realize that your name was being connected with a deadly explosion?
Well, after the explosion occurred, they ran around, you know, trying to find out what they could, so they just attacked our neighborhood and started questioning people, you know, dragging people downtown. You know, they drug me down there a couple times, probably I'd say three or four, and, you know, just questioned me and asked me what I knew, if I knew who did it and stuff like that. Sometimes they just make us, you know, drop us off and make us walk home or call a friend or call a family member to come get us from downtown. But at the time, I was on a probation violation, or I was on probation for a bicycle theft. And so I violated probation, and they had me placed in Jackson County Jail for 28 days. While I was there, they had two informants, known informants, I guess they've been doing this for a while, in my unit, and they said I was in there bragging about it. That's when my mom and dad hired an attorney. After I got charged with 6 counts of second-degree murder, my mom and dad hired an attorney, John O'Connor, and he proved that the witnesses were lying against me. You know, one of them says that I was bragging about it when some certain cartoon was being aired, when actually I was in the visiting room visiting my family. You know, jail records showed that I was in the visiting room. So,
Mike, is that how you understand the story too?
Yeah, I've talked to both of those witnesses, and right after Brian was indicted by the county in 1989, both those witnesses came forward and said, "We're lying." And partly because his lawyer had interviewed them at least once. And so the indictment was dropped in 89.
When you received a sentence, Brian, of life in prison without the chance of parole. I mean, do you remember absorbing that information and how you thought about it as really a young guy?
Well, like I said, it started out on a state level, and once my attorney proved that those witnesses were lying against me, you know, he's basically said, okay, now you're free, move on with your life. You don't have to worry about this no more. And this case went unsolved for 8.5 years more. And then, you know, the families were questioning what's going on with this. You know, our family members are dead. You know, something needs to be done about this. So they started...
Of the firefighters.
Right. They started making phone calls and asking for justice. So that's when Dave True and them got together, ATF agent Dave True and them got together and figured out a way to close this case. And that's how they started combing our neighborhood with all of our friends and family, you know, that were in trouble with the law. So that's how we'll get them.
Do you remember realizing that you were, in fact, that you stood a very good chance of going to prison for this, of being convicted, of being found guilty?
Yeah, when they aired it on Unsolved Mysteries, you know, looking for information leading to this case and put all those reward posters up in the jails and hanging them off overpasses, you know, I was praying for the best, you know, and waiting for the worst.
So you did go to prison, and you went to prison believing you would be there for life. I mean, how did you emotionally, spiritually, and practically handle that situation?
It was just one step in front, I mean, one foot in front of the other. It was very difficult. It was like a dream. It was hard to comprehend something like that was going to happen. You know, when this thing started and our attorneys got on the case, they advised us, you know, to try to make a deal, because we were going to look at a life sentence if we took this to trial. But I felt that this was going to be our opportunity to clear our names.
But just thinking aside from the legal stuff, I mean, Irene, really personally, how did you handle it? How did you handle life in prison?
Hope, you know, faith in my family and support. I couldn't give up on them, so I just kept moving forward.
When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll hear about the resentencing that set Brian Shepherd free, how he's adjusting to life on the outside, and the questions people are still asking about what justice means in a case like this. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've been hearing a story today that has at least two sides and no easy answers. The story of an explosion near Bruce R. Watkins Drive in 1988 that killed 6 Kansas City firefighters in the line of duty and set into motion a very complicated set of legal proceedings. We're hearing it from the perspective of a 45-year-old man who was a teenager when the blast occurred. He was convicted along with 4 others and served 22 years of a life sentence without parole, insisting in the whole time that he was innocent. A resentencing hearing earlier this month set him free. Brian Shepherd, welcome back.
Hello.
And journalist Mike McGraw, who started following the story for the Kansas City Star in 2005 and continued that work after leaving the Star. Hello again to you, too.
Hi, Gina.
Why was Brian granted a resentencing hearing?
He was granted a hearing under a Supreme Court case in 2012 called Miller versus Alabama. And that case, based on recent brain science, basically said if you were a juvenile at the time the crime was committed, you got a life sentence, you get a chance to argue that factors in your life may have misled you toward this crime. What I think is fascinating about this case is that Brian's attorney wanted to present evidence of actual innocence, and she wasn't allowed to. The U.S. attorney wanted to require Brian to admit involvement in the crime in order to get a shorter sentence. The judge did not allow either of those things. But in his own order, he raised issues of actual innocence.
So, I mean, why is that fascinating to you?
He didn't have to go there. All he had to do and all Brian's attorney had to prove was that indeed he had a tumultuous early life and that he was 17 at the time of the crime. And he had forbidden both sides to kind of go down this hallway they wanted to go down. And Instead, he went there himself. To me, that's pretty interesting.
Brian, did you have high hopes for this opportunity? Did you allow yourself to believe there was a chance you were going to be walking free, or did that feel maybe like too much to hope?
Well, after all of our appeals over the years that were denied, even Judge Gaitan, you know, the judge that released me, you know, denied our 2255, our certificate of appealability, and that's where we started tracking down witnesses to come back and tell the truth. When this ruling came down, you know, it was, wow, this is, you know, something that could really possibly walk me out of jail. I didn't think I was going to get immediate release. You know, a lot of people didn't, you know. I wasn't prepared for it.
What do you think is the role of the journalistic involvement and interest in your case? I mean, I hear that you have, I see that you have tattoos on your arms, but I hear that one of them is of the Kansas City Star.
Yeah, you know, I'll carry this case with me for the rest of my life. So, you know, it's just a part of who I am, just like the firemen family members, you know, they'll be a part of my life as well. It's just something that I chose to do in remembrance of both sides of this thing.
So the star represents the two-sidedness of it to you?
Somewhat, yeah.
I think it's fascinating that I think Brian should tell you a little bit about the card he got the last day he was in prison.
Tell me about the card you got, Brian.
That's emotional. I wish I'd have brought it with me. It's because, you know, like I have the tattoo on my back to remind myself, which I'll never forget anyway. It's, you know, I received a card. I received my mail as I was being released. They put me in the cell and gave me some street clothes, and then they handed me my mail for that day. And I just happened to be looking through there, and I seen the return address on there and the name, and I was just like, what is this? You know, I couldn't believe it. You know, the name that was on there. I opened it up and started reading.
Wait, what was the name? What did the name mean to you?
It was one of the names of the firefighters who had been killed that night.
One of the family members. You know, because of me telling my story and being interviewed and, you know, how I live my life inside, you know, with the Sweat Lodge and my spiritual well-being.
I'm going to have you tell us more about that, but continue with the card.
You know, I talk about how I get in the Sweat Lodge and I pray for my families, I pray for my enemies, and I pray for the fallen firefighters and their families. And I do this all the time. You know, like I said, they'll be a part of my life forever. You know, that's the main thing is to get to the truth of this thing. You know, they deserve the truth just as well as my family and myself, you know.
So you spent time in prison tapping into a very specific kind of spirituality, sweat lodges. How did that fit into your time in prison? And I mean, prison is just where you have spent your early adulthood.
Well, I mean, you can follow different paths while you're inside, you know. And, you know, I did go down the wrong path a couple of times. And, you know, I didn't want to continue that way. And I wanted to show my family and my supporters that, you know, I was in there doing what I could to better myself. You know, if they're going to fight for my life, I'm going to sit in here and show them that I'm fighting too. So that's what I did. I didn't just jump into the Native American community. That's part of my life already. You know, my dad's Native. My co-defendants are Native. And I just decided to change my life, and that's what became of it.
How did you discover sweat lodges as an option for you, as something that could bring you some kind of solace or, as you said, improvement?
Well, and you know, everybody has there's different religions inside the prison system. You know, you have several different, you know, Christians and Muslims and, you know, Catholics and Judaism. So, you know, I'm Native American, so I chose that path. And it did help a lot because you get in there and you suffer, you know. It's a sweat lodge. It's like a sauna, you know, and it's really tough. You get in there and you pray and you sing, and it helped with my transformation of, you know, becoming a man, you know.
At what point, I mean, what was it like for you to stand trial again before your own family, as well as the relatives of the firefighters who died in that explosion? I mean, this was, you didn't know how this was going to turn out, but there you are appearing before all these people again.
At the resentencing hearing?
Yeah.
You know, my attorney, you know, we talked about it, about testifying. She told me I didn't have to, but we both came to the conclusion that if I didn't and I was sent back to prison, that I would regret it. And just like I regretted not testifying on my own behalf at the original trial, I've regretted that for, you know, 20 plus years. So we decided that I would testify, and that was probably the hardest thing I've ever done.
I feel like maybe this is a little obvious, but I'm not positive if what I assume is hard about it is what was hard about it. What was hard about it for you?
Well, like I said, it was probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life besides sitting in prison for 21 and a half years for somebody else. You know, it was traumatic, emotional, nerve-wracking. I mean, there's so many words to describe it.
You know, we know the outcome, which is that the judge announces that you are going to be a free man after all this time, after believing that you're going to serve your life in prison. And I can't imagine what that moment must have been like for you. Are you able to describe what that moment, about your realization that this was actually going to happen?
Well, like I said, I wasn't prepared for it. I don't think anybody was. You know, and I'll say it forever, you know, without the attorney that I had, I'd probably be back in prison right now for another 10 or 15 years. I mean, Cynthia Short, she went above and beyond. I wouldn't trade her for 10 attorneys.
Mike, can you describe the courtroom scene when the judge's ruling was announced?
Yeah, it was very tense. I mean, you had three families of the firefighters who had all testified that Brian should stay in for life, regardless of the Supreme Court decision. On the other side, Brian's daughter, Ashley, had organized quite a group of people who sat on the other side on his behalf. When the judge first announced the 20 years, my first thought was he's going to give him 20 more years, when in fact the judge was saying basically time served. So it took a minute to dawn on me, too. But I think what's important here is that of those families who testified, the families of the firefighters, are not kind of monolithic. There are families of the firefighters, one of whom sent him that card in prison,
which I want to get back to,
who have long believed there's something wrong with this case. And they feel that some of the families have always had questions about whether the right people went to prison. So Brian gets this card in prison from one of those families that has questions about it. And they basically say, we hope the truth comes out. Good luck trying to tell the truth. And all that is kind of supercharged by a report that the Department of Justice did in 2011. They did a separate investigation of this case because of my stories that had claimed witnesses were pressured. Of course, they found that they didn't do anything wrong, that the Star was wrong about that. But the fascinating thing about that report is the last paragraph said, however, during our investigation, we found two new witnesses who were unknown to the prosecution at the time who were probably involved in this explosion. Now, I've been trying to ask the U.S. Attorney's Office ever since 2011, number one, who are these attorneys? Who are these new people? I also wanted to ask them, why would five people sit in prison doing life in prison without rolling over on these two new perpetrators? And the U.S. attorney has not responded to those questions in years.
And still hasn't.
And I think that's part of the reason some of the families have questions about this case.
So now these are the questions that remain. But Brian, I mean, I want to talk to you about getting ready to leave prison. What was that like for you?
It was very hard. You know, like I said, I wasn't prepared for it. You know, the sentence came down on a Friday. I had to sit in CCA for another 2 days.
You're a guy who's lived your whole adult life in prison, and, you know, you're in your 40s now. What, I mean, I'm really just wanting to know what it was like, thinking 46. I mean, I'm wanting to know what it was like to get ready to leave, to think about what's going to be a totally different life for you.
Yeah, it was scary. It was emotional. You know, those last couple of days were traumatic, you know, traumatizing. You know, I was excited. I was ready to walk out into an alien world. You know, things have changed so much. You know, I've been gone a long time.
What has surprised you the most about life on the outside after all these years? A different, like you're saying, a different world.
Well, just the technology. You know, it's working a phone. I've never had a cell phone before. This is my first one. You know, I'm still struggling with that. You know, just...
Like he's already on Instagram. I'm not on Instagram. He's acclimating pretty well, I think.
Yeah, I adjust pretty fast, you know. It's still hard, you know. It seemed like, you know, things are moving really fast. You know, I can't catch up. It seems like I can't catch up. You know, I'm not doing enough. You know, all the people that are supporting me, supporting this case, you know, it's like I said, it's not like I felt like I'm not doing enough to show them how grateful I am.
What are you hoping to do to show that? I mean, what do you think would show that enough?
You know, just like I said, with changing my life inside, I want to get out here and do what I can to show them that I was worth saving.
Brian Shepherd, Mike McGraw, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're headed for a break. Then when we come back, forgotten architecture sits in ruins in plain view. The story of a crumbling old hospital near 18th and Vine. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's next. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now for something entirely different. The ruins of an old hospital tell a story about race in our city. For that, let's talk to Michael Adams, a local historian and genealogist. Hi, Michael.
Hey.
What was the Wheatley Provident Hospital?
Wheatley Provident was a hospital that got its start through a need by the African-American community here in Kansas City to establish, I guess, better facilities.
When are we talking about?
We're talking about, I want to say, between 1915 and 1920. The hospital had its roots, I guess, in several different area hospitals that came together to form one singular hospital.
So what was the need they were filling, as you call it? You know, you said that it was filling a need for the African-American community.
There was a hospital called... I think it was General Hospital Number 2, which was established by the city. That hospital was kind of full of graft. It was for African Americans. General Hospital Number 1 was for the white populace. But like I said, General Hospital Number 2 was, had a lot of like graft. And so the African American community here in Kansas City wasn't really getting the needed services that they required.
And so how does Wheatley Provident enter the picture?
Wheatley enters the picture circa 1915, like I said before, in the fact that it kind of stepped in and filled that need that General Hospital Number 2 did not establish.
Where is it and what does it look like today?
It's on 1826 Forest. And it is kind of like a big limestone L-shaped building. It's two stories tall, and it is completely dilapidated.
Dilapidated how? I mean, there are some really compelling details about this picture that you can paint for us.
Yeah, the structure is still standing, like the limestone kind of outside of it. But if you kind of take a drive by it, which I'd recommend that everybody, you know, who's listening to this do. Building, the door is open, actually can walk inside. Once you walk inside, you kind of look to your left and right, you see just trash, you know, strewn about. And if you kind of go up the steps, on the second floor and kind of gaze to your right. You look up and see a giant hole kind of in the middle of the building.
What got you curious about it? I mean, the Central Standard team found out about this story from an interview you did with an online publication on failed architecture, mm-hmm. like a whole website dedicated to what they call urban failure. And this hospital is discussed on this website, tagged with the keywords ruin and dystopia. That is pretty bleak.
It is, yeah. I kind of came to the hospital through my kind of ancestry doing research on genealogy. I am related to my great-grandmother. She did the fundraising efforts, you know, to get the hospital established. And so through her, that is kind of how I am related to this project. My friend Benjamin Bush, who is kind of doing architectural studies in Berlin, he's the one who contacted me about writing the article for a failed architecture.
There's a detail in this article, I mean, the detail of the structure itself, that the words asylum mm-hmm. still sort of hover over a part of this structure.
Yeah, in the 1980s, it was used as a haunted house attraction. And so they're the ones who put the asylum sign on the top of the, I think, the right structure.
So there's like... there's the building's medical use, and then there's something about that that gets kind of twisted in like a fictional existence that this building has had, the purpose of which was to scare people.
Yeah, it kind of, you know, obfuscates in quite a really dramatic way the initial origins of the hospital, which was to fulfill a need in the African-American community. And so you see it later on being used to amuse people.
Why is this building in ruins?
After it was used, I think, as the haunted house attraction, there was no more usage for it for whatever reason, you know, within the community.
But why did it close originally? Why did it stop being a hospital?
The operations moved to Martin Luther King Medical Center, which I believe eventually became Truman Medical Center.
Do you, I mean, so this is as part, this is an article in a, now in a publication on failed architecture mm-hmm. or like subtitled just generally urban failure. Do you see Wheatley Provident as a failure?
Currently, I definitely do. You kind of want to make sure that you maintain historic structures like this. And in that way, I definitely do see it as a failure kind of on behalf of the city and, you know, some of the populace within the community that let that happen.
You say currently you see it as a failure. Is there a point in history where you see it as something else? I mean, is there another side of the story that needs to be acknowledged?
Well, right now, we just had a meeting the other day about we got kind of assembled a group of people together to kind of discuss plans for what we'd like to see happen with the building. And so we want to get the building put on the National Register of Historic Places. Currently, I think it's owned by someone else, kind of based out of Baldwin, Kansas.
But what is it about its past that makes you want to commemorate it?
The significant amount of effort that the African-American community here in Kansas City put into it, I think, really requires that we pay deference to the building itself.
Tell me about that effort.
Like I was saying earlier, my grandmother, Clara Adams, it was my great-grandmother, she raised quite a bit of the funds to get that hospital, you know, the structure up, along with several other members of the community. There was the doctor who started the hospital, his name was John Perry. He was from Tennessee. He went to Meharry Medical School, and he was the one that initially identified the need for a private African-American hospital here in Kansas City. So you have, you know, all these disparate kind of geographic elements coming in to, you know, get this effort off the ground. And I think that is a story worth telling.
What do you know about the people who came there for treatment? Have you found any just like personal stories of what people experienced in this hospital or no?
I know a couple people. There's a gentleman who I'm in contact with. His father was a doctor there in the 1950s. My aunt, I think she was born there. And so the hospital is still quite a bit relevant to the community in that regard. I mean, you know, there's still a significant amount of people alive in Kansas City who have links to it.
Have those people told you stories?
They have. I know that the pediatric ward at the hospital was one of a very like pioneering pediatric ward.
Pioneering in what way?
I think it was the first of its kind in the Midwest. And then they also trained a significant amount of nurses. They had a nurse training school.
Do you think, I mean, why do you think that even though the building itself has essentially crumbled, you know, except for some stark remains, why do you think it's also kind of still there?
It's a good question. I think it hasn't been demolished now because it's on the national, it's on the Kansas City Register of Historic Places, excuse me. And so I think that has been really saving it from demolishment. There's also, if you, you know, kind of go online and you do a simple Google search, there's a significant amount of people who have had interest in this hospital over, you know, the last 20 years and are kind of wondering why nothing has been done with it.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that it would almost represent a greater effort for, like, if this building had been demolished than that it hasn't? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, rather than preserving it, I guess if they demolished it, it would probably be, would cost more or something like that. I would say so.
With the story it tells, I mean, kind of, I mean, I would say it's literally in plain view on the city streets. Why haven't we heard more about Wheatley Provident, do you think?
I think kind of back to the point that we were getting to earlier with the haunted house thing that definitely kind of obfuscated its historic presence. A lot of the members of the community who were around at the point in time when it was its most at its most prominent, those members have since moved on or passed away, even though, you know, there are a lot of people who have memories of the hospital.
You talked about a doctor who worked there. I mean, this would have been a successful professional doing really, like, important work. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that there are stories in that, too, that need to be told? I mean, just the idea that there was in this community a hospital with successful physicians. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Vine Street was a whole community kind of unto itself. I mean, you know, in addition to a hospital, there was a high school. There were several kind of like local bars. There were places that you can go and dance. There was a movie theater. It was its own kind of self-contained area.
Well, our time is up, but genealogist Michael Adams, thank you for telling the story of Wheatley Provident Hospital. It sounds like what's been held up as an example of urban failure here in Kansas City is much more complex if you go back to the beginning. And thanks for getting us started asking questions about this.
Thank you very much.
And on that note, we're going to jog on out of here, but you can listen to anything you missed on today's show, the story of Brian Shepherd and a 1988 explosion in Kansas City, as well as this conversation about Wheatley Provident Hospital, at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have all of that ready for you later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard, and you can listen to any of our past shows while you're there. Tomorrow, there have always been people who prepared for the worst, as in total apocalypse or nuclear disaster. That kind of thing. These days, they're called preppers, and there are camps of them on both sides of the political aisle. Is this what common ground looks like? Tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.